All right, thanks for tuning in. You're listening to Gaucho Amigos. I'm Alex. Some good news today for those of you who enjoyed my interview with Rick Murata from a couple weeks ago, and you are an FM Pods subscriber. There's more of me and Rick. Yes, today I share with you some bonus conversation with the great session drummer. You know, Rick had a couple more Steely Dan related anecdotes, but also some stories about working with other artists like Laura Nero and Warren Zevon that I thought were pretty special. So I wanted to share those with you as part of the bonus feed here on Gaucho Amigos. And once again, let me just say huge thanks to Rick for taking such a generous amount of time to talk and share some stories. And I also want to give a very special thank you to both Robin Flans and Barney Hurley, two kind of contacts from the Steely Dan world who helped put this interview together. You know, I always appreciate getting the opportunity to talk to a Steely Dan legend. So thank you very much to both Robin and Barney. And all right, without further ado, this is part two of my interview with Rick Murata. Enjoy.
One of my favorites that I used to do when I toured with Linda Ronstadt, she chose the song, which was very interesting to me, was and I go, wow, what a great song. I never heard this. Where was it? She looked at me, she goes, Rick, it's a Steely Dan song. And it was called Dirty Work. And it's about prostitution. I'm a fool to do your dirty work. And it's the odd time section in there as well. And I listened to that and I go, my God, I was so naive to what really great stuff. They've just got an unbelievable catalog of incredibly smart writing. But you know, the other thing was when they were in Bard, I think those two weirdos would go and I think that I have to tell you something. I used to put all of the emphasis on Donald, because Donald was always playing on the sessions and singing, right, and Walter was just there. So then we had worked on a couple of things, and then I get a call. I was touring, and I think I was coming back from Japan, and I get a call from Walter saying, Rick, I'm going to work on my solo album. And I was wondering if maybe you want to do something. I said, sure. I had no idea what it was going to be like. And he was in Maui, and I was going to stop to meet my ex in Hawaii.
Okay.
For a vacation, we were going to take a little time off. So he had a cassette sent to me of his demos, just him. And he was living on Maui, and I'm living in, and I was staying on Molokai.
Right.
And he was, so this is after he had left New York and he was trying to get clean, and he was living in Maui. And I remember I got this, I had a Walkman and I had headphones, and I'm sitting on the beach and we were just sitting there, and I'm listening and I'm looking across at whatever islands I could see. And I'm listening to these songs that Walter had done himself. They were unbelievable.
Yeah.
Two sisters shaking, one after another. So I call him and I said, Walter, yeah, this is great. I really want to do this. And we went, he goes, okay, great. We're going to be in New York. In LA. And I went back, came back to LA, and we started work on it at Motown in LA, at Motown Studios. And it was just like doing a Steely Dan record. And I was really prepared for it. And I really liked these songs. And I really liked that Walter explained them to me. Now, this is Walter's solo record.
Yeah.
I don't know if you ever heard of any of it.
Oh, yeah. I've heard it a lot. I love it. 11 Tracks of Whack, I think you're probably talking about.
Oh, man, it was so good. And
yeah.
I played on a bunch of stuff and nothing. I don't think any of it ended up on the record. I don't really know. But yeah. I know.
Huh.
And the same thing happened with Donald. I'm in LA and Donald is working on his solo record, Nightfly. He goes, can you do some work on the record? I go, okay, sure. Where, where's the studio? He goes, we're at Picaro's house. And so now Picaro calls me and he goes, hey, Rick, can you do this? I said, Jeff, what are you doing? They've already been working on it for a week. And this is the kind of guy Jeff Picaro was. And I swear they broke the mold with this guy. He's yeah. one of the best human beings on the planet. And forget about how he played.
Amazing.
He calls me and he goes, you know, Rick, I was working on Donald's record and, you know, we're working on it for like week in his studio at his house, at Jeff's house. And he goes, and in the middle of one of the tracks, I said, you know what? I'm not the right guy for this record. Rick Marotta should be playing on this record. You got to call Rick to do this. And that's what happened. Yeah. So now I'm going every day to Jeff's house. He had this beautiful studio behind his house out here on Hartsook. And I went every day to the studio. We cut tracks and Jeff would come walking in from the house because the studio was behind the house. He'd come walking in with a cup of coffee. What's going on, guys? And I'm like, there's something wrong with this picture. It's Jeff Picaro should be sitting here playing. And it turns out neither of us ended on the record. Steve Jordan did the record. And yeah. it was like an extension of a Steely Dan record.
Yeah.
Both of those guys. You know, when we were doing when I was doing Walter's solo record, when I was doing Donald's solo record, it was just like doing a Steely Dan record.
So the process was already kind of built in.
The process was the same.
Yeah.
But my point was that Walter was, I realized when I was working on Walter's solo album, how much of a contribution he made to that great music. He was great. And those two guys together, that was a team that you don't get that often.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I heard that they helped each other out with each other's solo albums. So like Walter produced Comic Curiod, which is one of Donald's solo albums. And I know Donald helped Walter get through some of this material on 11 Tracks of Wax. So, you know,
they were like a married couple. They bicker. They were always out together. When they came to town, one year they came to town to LA to do, they were doing the, I think they were at the Greek Theater and they called me and they said, come to the gig, but let's go. We're going to go to dinner first. So I went to dinner. We went out to dinner one night and Peter Erskine was playing with them at that time on that particular tour. And they did Peg. And I remember Peter sounded unbelievable. He was so good. And he gave me a lot of really great feedback. Peter and I are very, very old friends. And he gave me a lot of great feedback. And so did Keith Carlock about Peg. You know, I surprised Keith and I went to this clinic he did. And in the clinic, he didn't know I was going. And in his clinic, he plays Peg. And he happened to say, you know, I'm going to be playing this song. And I feel a little bit weird because the guy who created this part is here. Rick Marotta's here. How you doing, Rick? Blah, blah, blah. And he played it and he played the shit out of it. I mean, nobody plays better than Keith.
He's phenomenal.
Favorite.
Yeah, he's
unbelievable.
He's been doing it for a long time now, too, with the Steely Dan.
Long time.
Yeah.
Really long time.
Yeah.
They'd be fools. They would be fools. Or Donald would be a fool not to have to do the show, to do the tour without him because he just is such a chameleon and he's so unique in his own style of playing. And when he integrates his style with our styles that we did it, you can't do better than that. You know, everybody comes up to me. I've done hundreds of really big, really good records, really good things that I'm proud of. And first thing, people say to me, well, what have you done? Like when I play a lot of golf and I'll go to the club or something. And, oh, this is the guy. You're the Steely Dan guy, right? Obama. President Obama. I really like Steely Dan. I mean,
Obama said that to you?
Yeah.
You're kidding me.
Swear to God.
Holy moly. So I didn't even know he liked Steely Dan. You just, you know.
I really like Steely Dan. He said that to me when we were playing golf. I was playing golf at Vineyard Golf Club, Martha's Vineyard. And it was Obama's birthday, he was there, and I brought Milo, my assistant. At that time, he was, I think he was seven or eight. I said, listen, if you see Obama, say, it's his birthday, say, happy birthday, Mr. President. And sure enough, we're walking up to the range, and it was his birthday, and he had, like, blocked out a bunch of time. And I was taking Milo to just play with him because I love him. He, you know, we all live together, really, basically. Yeah. And so we were going up, and I said, oh, there's Obama. And he recognized him, and I walked away. I let him, you know, I didn't care about that stuff. I just walked away. And I said, Milo, you know, say happy birthday. Your mom's going to be really happy. So he goes over and he starts talking to Obama, and Obama's getting in the cart to go play. And I stepped away. I just got a smile on my face. I'm so happy that Milo's doing this. Milo goes, happy birthday, Mr. President. Thank you, young man. Blah, blah, blah. You playing golf today, blah, blah, blah. They have a little conversation for a minute. And then Obama's going to the first tee to tee off. And as he pulls away in the cart, he looks over at me and points. He goes, I really like Steely Dan. And I went, you know, it was really funny. I was so taken by surprise, but I went like this. Oh. And then I went down, and Jason Benko, who runs the golf course there, he's the head of golf operations. He goes, did I hear that somebody recognized and said something to you up there? I said, yeah, it was so weird. He goes, yep. He knows exactly who you are and knows what he goes. No, he knows what everybody does here.
Wow. Incredible.
But it was of all the records of all everything. I never really talked to him. He says, I say hello. If I see him, hello, how you doing, Mr. President? If I see him in the locker room or something, he goes, I really like Steely Dan. That's the extent of our conversation.
That's amazing.
But that's how big Steely Dan is.
I interviewed Bill Schnee. Do you know him? He's an engineer.
Yeah.
He said the same thing. He said, I've worked with the Beatles, and people still ask me more about Steely Dan.
Steely Dan. And you know, Schnee, but didn't Schnee do the, he was the master. He was the mastering engineer, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I think he only, and he actually didn't end up finishing Asia. Like they brought in, didn't bring in, I think Elliot Shiner kind of just took over because they were so particular that he was just like, I can't, but he worked with them. You know, he worked on Asia quite a bit. So,
you know, I heard a story. This is a story. It's hearsay. You may have heard this because you know more about Steely Dan than I do, really. But I heard, and it made sense to me.
Yeah.
Because I used to hang out with them in the studio a lot, too. Yeah. When after the tracks were done and everything, we would hang out. They were mixing one of the tracks. Can't remember which one it was. Mixing the track, and they get to the mastering stage. There's no bass drum. No bass drum on the track.
What? What happened?
And they go, and whoever, it might have been Bill Schnee. Somebody said to them, you know, there's no bass drum on this track. It's because when you listen over and over and over and over, your brain creates the images and it's there. You hear it, but it's not really there. You just know it so much. And they had to go back and remix the song. All they had to do was put the bass drum back in. It was muted on the mix.
I just forgot.
That's a story I heard. I wasn't in the room when it happened, but I certainly have experienced it myself where I go, holy shit. I left out one of the guitar parts, or I left out this part, or something on something I might have been mixing, because you know, you just hear it, your brain works that way. You know, I really like Mark Knopfler's playing, and there's a friend of mine who's a friend at that same club where Obama is. There's a friend of mine who's a member at the club who's friends with Mark Knopfler. He has nothing to do with music. He's a finance guy, but he's good friends with Knopfler, and he's good friends with Eric Clapton. And he said, he said to me, Rick, have you ever played with Mark Knopfler? And I said, no, I haven't. He goes, I went to England to see him. I was hanging out with him at his house. And, you know, he likes hanging out with these guys, and he likes talking to me about music. And he said to me, and I said, no, I never played with him, but that's a drag because he's really good. And I really like his playing on certain things. He plays one of my favorite solos ever on this song, This Is Us, with Emmylou Harris, where, man, he plays, the guitar part on that is one of the best guitar parts.
My friend Tim is an amazing guitarist. He just plays. He lives in Pittsburgh, but his hero is Mark Knopfler.
Yeah,
Knopfler. Like his absolute number one favorite guitarist, and he's like, and you know, he's a great guitarist himself. He knows everything about guitars, guitarists. He's a guitar nerd. He says Knopfler is his number one. I did a podcast with him, and he talked.
Well, Knopfler, yeah. I said to my friend Dan Stanton on the Vineyard, I said, no, I never worked with him, but boy, it's too bad because I really think he's good. Somebody recently, I read somewhere, or somebody told me that Knopfler played on Hey 19 or Time Out of Mind, and that he was interviewed about it, and he said he was there like all day long.
It was a horrible experience.
Yes. But at least I got to work with him.
You guys are on credited on Time Out of Mind together.
I didn't even know that.
Yeah.
Didn't know that.
Yeah. Apparently they made him cry because he was only a kid at the time. He was like 21. This is right when he was getting started. Donald heard him on the first Dire Straits album. Was like, you know, this kid can play. Let's get him in here for Gaucho. He did a little bit of, like, they couldn't get it to work. And apparently they like made him play it over and over, kind of like you were saying, how they would make you play stuff over and over and you didn't want to, but he was just a kid. So they just kept playing over and over. And I think they made him cry or something. So,
oh, that's a drag.
That was the first and last time Mark Knopfler ever worked with Donald Fagen, was on that track. So there you go. So you got, if you look at the credits on Gaucho, drums, Rick Marotta.
Now my guitar experience on Time Out of Mind is completely the opposite. I was in and out, bang, take it or leave it.
You nailed it. Yeah, I love that song. I think your playing on it is fantastic. It's almost a disco. It's got that steady.
Yeah,
you know, it's really more of a kind of the syncopated the, you know, it's just perfect.
I think a lot of that was because I remember we played it to a click, and if I remember correctly, it was just me and Donald. So there wasn't a whole lot of, you know, I didn't have to go straying anywhere.
Yeah,
but who knows? You know, Donald knows more than I do about it.
She tells him she thinks she needs to be free. He tells her he doesn't understand. She takes his hand. She tells him nothing's working out the way they planned. She's so many women. Can't find the one who was his friend, so he's hanging on to half a heart, but he can't have the restless part, so he tells her to hasten down the
road. I have so many stories about Warren. We toured with Warren. Waddy Wachtel brought me in on that, and I love Lawyers, Guns, and Money, but I mentioned earlier, I mean, everything out of his mouth. He called me and he said, let's write something. Okay, let's write something. So he said to me, just give me a title. And I didn't know what to say. He goes, forget the changes, forget the chords, forget this, forget that, forget just the title. If we have a title, we can write anything. And you go back and you listen to his records. One of the first times I worked with him, we're walking down the street from the studio. I just met him. And I said, I got to ask you about this song that you wrote. Where did you get this lyric, Hasten Down the Wind? And he said to me, very matter-of-factly, you know, he said to me, well, Rick, you know, I think I was going through a breakup and I was thinking all the ways I could say, take a hike, beat it, get out of here. I don't want to see you again. Hasten down the wind. And I thought, this guy, the genius gets thrown around a lot. We just talked about Donald and Walter, pretty much geniuses. Warren Zevon, absolutely top of the list. One of the greatest of all time.
Agreed. Yeah.
And we got to tour. We toured together. We hung together. We have so many stories together. And I did a lot. I co-produced Bad Luck Streak and Dancing School with Greg Ladani.
Oh, Greg called. Okay. Wow.
Oh yeah. So we're doing vocals on that. We're doing all the drums on that. Everything that we did together on that album.
Yeah. How about in person? What was he like?
Just the greatest.
Yeah.
A lot of drinking.
Yeah. So you drank? Did you drink with them at all?
Yes.
Yeah.
There was a lot of drinking going on, but not. Yeah. I didn't drink as much. The bad luck streak in dancing school happened when we were on the road. I forgot where we were. I can't remember the gig. But it was a club like in Philly or Chicago or someplace. And he had taken dancing lessons. The record company wanted him to be more of a personality, and it was horrible. He would jump up on the piano and he would dance like John Travolta in Saturday Night Live. And I'm not kidding. But he would be, you know, he'd have a bottle of vodka on stage with him and he was drinking. And then you got to understand, I loved Warren Zevon and I miss him. I talk about him all the time. Love him. So he's dancing and he's standing on top of the piano and he leaps off the piano and lands on his knees on the stage. But you know, when you do gigs, I don't know if you play, there are these, they bundle the chords and they wrap them in tape so that instead of having 10 chords or 18 chords, there's one big block of chord all wrapped together in these ties. He landed on his knees on the chord and we end up going to the hospital.
Jeez.
He has to go to the hospital.
Yeah.
To cut his pants off of his leg, his knee blew up, and we did. I don't know how many of the gigs we did after that in a wheelchair.
Yeah, Jesus.
Next comes Bad Luck Streak in Dancing School.
That's where it came from, right?
Yeah, that was my memory of it. but I loved him. All right, who else?
All right, it's a little bit of a different vibe, but any memories of working with Roxy Music on Avalon?
Absolutely. I produced, I got hired to do Brian Ferry's first solo album.
Okay.
It was called The Bride Stripped Bare in Switzerland. So we spent 2 months. First, I got hired to play on it and I quit. Wadi Wachtel was coming out a week later than me. I flew out first. And I was there with Alan Spener, who's again no longer with us, and Neil Hubbard, guitar player, and me. And we're waiting for Wadi. And Brian went through a breakup the day I arrived in Switzerland. His friend meets me at the train station because the flight got diverted to Zurich, then to Geneva. And he meets me and he says, he drives me from Zurich to back to from Lausanne or someplace. I'd take a train to Lausanne and then he takes me to Montreux where we did the album. And he says, Brian just found out his girlfriend, Jerry, is now with Mick Jagger. Oh, so no. Brian was a mess. Yeah. And I spent a week there with these two guys, with these other guys, and it was just a nightmare. Alan Spener was having a really tough time with drugs at the time. His girlfriend was there. There was a lot of heroin. And long story short, I quit. And Mark Fenwick walked in. And I was the only one working in the studio every day. We're waiting for Wadi. I'm in the studio. I'm playing, you know, I'm coming up with parts on piano and on guitar. And especially on Same Old Blues, I think. I had recorded that all by myself for a while. Anyway, when I said I wanted to leave and they didn't have to pay me, I'm just going to go home. Mark Fenwick came to my room at the hotel and he said, we don't want you to leave. We want you to stay and produce the album. I said, okay, that changes everything. So I stayed and Wadi and I produced it together. So then when we were done with that album, which we did a lot of work on, I then did Manifesto with Brian asked me to overdub a bunch of stuff in New York, which I did. And I think Brian, some of the tracks from his solo album went on to Avalon.
Okay.
And that's how that came about. Okay. So it was a leftover track. But then Brian Ferry is another, it's interesting that you bring him up because Brian, I was out of my depth with Brian because there's a perfect example of my narrow-mindedness getting in the way of a real artist. Brian Ferry is a real artist. He's not a fake artist. He's real. This guy he created this character.
Yeah.
And he sang as this character, and not everybody connected with it. And while I was in the studio, I was trying, as I'm producing, I'm trying to turn Brian into Michael McDonald or somebody that, you know, a different kind of a thing. And it wasn't who Brian was. Fortunately, I was with my partner, Waddy Wachtel, and Waddy was reeling me in a little bit, and Waddy would do more of the production on the vocal side of things because I was just getting in the way. You know, I was doing a lot of the string overdubs and a lot of those other things. But at the end, when it was all done, it was very tense. At the end, when it was all done, I remember he used I think he used the track from the solo album on his Avalon. And then, but I remember I also overdubbed a bunch of drums on Manifesto as well.
Got it. Yeah, I just saw your name on To Turn You On by Roxy Music, which is a great song. So I think
that's from the solo record.
Got it.
I think that's
one of these. Yeah, and that Avalon became a really big album, actually. Like, people know that record really
well.
That
was a great record.
Yeah.
Is it raining in New York? Down Fifth Avenue. And off Broadway after dark. Love the lights, don't you? I could walk you through the park if you're feeling blue or whatever. Spring, summer, whenever. Winter through fall. I'd do anything to turn you on. Anything to turn you on. I'm the one. I'm the one. You don't have to look any further. I'm the one. I'm here right now.
Here's a bit of a curveball, because this is going back a ways, but I just happened to see it. Any memories of Paul Blay and Annette Peacock?
Yeah. Yes. I was in a band called Brethren. And we got called to play on Annette Peacock's record, which was basically she was free. It was free music, which was very different for me. And on the most memorable part of that was how odd it is to say this, but I remember Annette being incredibly good person. To me, that meant a lot because I didn't understand the music at all. But as a
person, her stuff is pretty out there.
It's right. Out there.
It's avant-garde.
It's very avant-garde.
Yeah.
Well, it's Paul Blay and Paul and Gary Peacock. Those were her husbands, I think. She had a daughter at the time. She was macrobiotic. She was very, very beautiful, very interesting, very, very, very much an artist. But here's the most memorable thing, and the thing I thank her for the most. I got to play with a hero of mine on one of her tracks, which was Elvin Jones, double drums, me and Elvin. And I walked into the room thinking, how is Elvin Jones going to put up with me? And he was, and I think it was in 6/8, which he wrote the book on playing in 6. And he was just the most beautiful, greatest. It was a great experience for me to play with him. When I'm in my studio, I have a picture up on the wall there of me and Elvin together at one of the Groove All-Stars gigs that I did. He did one time. Boy, I really liked that man. I really liked that man. And that guy could play.
So Annette gave you the chance to play with one of your heroes.
Yes.
That's great.
That's a weird one to pull out.
I feel like people ask about the same people over and over again. So sometimes I try to find other interesting artists like an Annette Peacock or Brian Ferry, people that don't get asked about as much because I want to know, you know, what you think.
Sure, I love that. I love talking about Brian because I Waddy actually ran into Brian in England, and I said, you know, please tell Brian I'm so sorry if I did anything offensive. And Brian, the incredible gentleman that he is, was like, I don't even know what he's talking about. Give Rick my love. And he sent me, you know, and Andy Newmark as well used to say, you know, Andy worked with Roxy and with Brian. And he always said that Brian never spoke badly of me. And I don't deserve that kind of kindness from him, because that was at a time when I was really, we were all going through a tough time, and I really, really respect him as an artist.
Yeah. Here's another one. I saw, in my opinion, somewhat of an underrated songwriter and someone who actually influenced Donald and Walter, is why I wanted to ask you about her. Laura Nyro.
Oh God. I was thinking when you're going to bring up artists, I'm thinking, you know, he's just, I really, should I say Laura Nero's name? Or let me see. Laura Nyro, it's funny, I was just thinking about her. I don't know what to say. I loved her. I loved working with her. She was completely unique. I think Charlie Colello had produced that album, and the combination of Charlie Colello and Laura Nyro was so odd to me, because Charlie was a very mainstream pop arranger, producer kind of guy. Laura, I want to just tell you one thing about a Laura Nyro record that I did. I've mentioned this before. I, again, will say, I know this is going to sound stupid when I hear it back, when I listen to this back, but I can't say a word bad about her, about any of these people. I really liked her. I was in awe of her. And we're working on her record. Here's the story. We're working on her album, and we're cutting a track. And she came up to me and she said, we're going to cut this again tomorrow. We're going to start on this song again tomorrow. Okay. Come in tomorrow. She comes in. She goes, Rick, I want to talk to you. Okay. She's pulls an 8x10 gloss, an 8x10 picture, black and white picture of a chair, like a bamboo wooden chair.
Yeah.
A picture of a chair. She says, on this song, I swear to you, Alex, I'm telling you the truth. You see this picture? You see this on this song? I want you to play like this chair, only green. And I looked at it and went, okay, I think I got it. And we went and played. She looked at me and she goes, that sounds perfect. And I, you know, if someone else had done that to me, I would have said, let's call Bellevue and have them sent there now. But with Laura, you knew she meant it. And you knew it made sense. And I had no idea what I was talking about, but I did know that when she started playing piano, I was going to know what she was talking about. And I didn't know what a black and white chair turned green was, but I did know that I was going to try to come up with that character, like I said earlier, and made her happy. That's a story that is completely unique to Laura Nyro.
Wow.
I'm glad you brought her up. I'm really glad.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the album I think that you played on, I don't know, I haven't spent as much time with as some of the other, but like the early ones, I love those albums. I think.
Yeah. I don't know if it was brilliant. A hit.
Yeah.
When she died, when she was got sick and died, I was pretty much crushed because we didn't hang out very much, but the little bit that we did hang out, she was just interesting and so nice. Just a genuinely, incredibly nice person. That's really great. Really not fair that she became ill and passed. I was really upset about it.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry that, you know, that
it was
happened.
A long time ago.
It was,
long
yeah. Time. Yeah, she's really interesting. I feel like, because the reason I bring her up is because I feel like she doesn't get her due, you know, compared to some of these other people. But
well,
you know,
she wasn't around long, and she didn't die. She didn't have a glamorous. She didn't, you know, she didn't OD. She didn't, you know, she's not Janis Joplin. She's not Jim Morrison. She's not Jimi Hendrix.
Yeah,
not any of those people. She just passed. And but you know, when you go back and you look at her catalog of songs and you think about what she would have been writing after that, she was brilliant.
Yeah. And Donald and Walter actually credit her as a major influence. Donald has said.
Really?
Yeah. I've seen in a few interviews. And if you actually listen to, because I'm such a Steely Dan nerd, I've listened to the, they wrote a bunch of songs at the Brill Building before they became Steely Dan, just Donald and Walter, just the two of them. And it sounds a little bit like Lauren Nero, like they were kind of still finding their own. So it's interesting. Remember, because somebody pointed this out on Twitter, and then it's a movie question, because I watched the movie and then somebody pointed out on Twitter, you're in the movie Showgirls.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Do you remember that?
Oh yeah. I was originally supposed to play the part that Robert Davi played of the seedy strip club owner.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yes. And Joanna Ray, who was my friend, was the casting director. And she said, Rick, I'd like you to come in and read for this part for Verhoeven. I was really nervous. And he said, really? She goes, yeah, she cast me in several movies. She liked me and we were good friends. And she was really nice. She was also... She was married previously to Aldo Ray, who was a huge star in the 50s.
Great and actor, yeah.
Quite a man. And she was this very genteel British woman. Very, very beautiful. Very, very nice. So she brings me in to read the part that Robert Davi ended up doing. And I got the part. But I'm sitting in the room with her. So I've got to talk to her like she's a stripper. And it's my friend, Joanna. I'm going, Joanna, I can't say this stuff to you. She goes, Rick, I'm a stripper. I'm a hooker. I'm a dude. Just do it. I did do it, but it was so she goes, it's great. He loved you. You got the part. And then she calls me and she says, Verhoeven panicked and he wants you for a movie. But he said he's so worried. He's got so many strippers and non-actors in these big roles. Right. He wanted to bring in a big actor. So he brought in Robert Davi to do the part, you know, and it was a pretty juicy, meaty part and it was good. And I was sorry I didn't get to do it, but she said he wants you in the movie. So you're in the movie. But we just don't know. We're going to put you as you're going to be the drunk and the this. And the, I was in a room with a bunch of strippers all day long. You want to know something very interesting?
You got a line in the movie, though. You're in there. So,
yeah, but there was the interesting thing is I walk onto the set. I got a dressing. I got a trailer and everything or a honey wagon, whatever it's called. But they were very nice to me. And I walk in and the woman who was doing wardrobe was Walter Becker's ex-girlfriend.
You're kidding.
And she's walking with me. Oh, God, where is it? She's holding a G-string. It's smaller than this. And she goes, what are you doing? She goes, I'm doing wardrobe on this movie. here it is. And she holds up this little string thing. I go, so weird. We're walking out onto the set. I'm going to do my scene. Nobody has, it's a bunch of extras. Me, I'm the actor. There's one other actor and strippers. And when I walk out, the strippers are all, they're naked. They're yeah. everybody. Nobody has, none of the women had clothes on. All the guys are, it's all guys. And there's me. So they're just doing their thing. And then I have lines. You know, I don't know how many lines I had, but it ended up maybe I had one line in the movie, but I have lines. As yeah. soon as words came out of my mouth, all the girls were like, hey, how are you? What are you doing? What's your name? What have you been? Blah, 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 blah. They're talking to me. And I'm like, and I said to her, I said, I'm trying to remember her name. I'm so sorry that I forgot it. I said, God, they got no clothes. She goes, Rick, I guarantee you, 15 minutes into this, you won't notice whether they have clothes on or not. And right. she was right. Yeah. Because you're doing the work. Right. You're in like a fake strip club and nobody had clothes on and you didn't even pay attention. It was not, there was nothing sexy about it.
Right. That's kind of how the movie is too, I think. But
yeah,
it's
wasn't
kind of
a great movie.
Well, it actually has a following now. Like it's one of those movies that has been kind of, you know, people see it as reclaimed or it's more artistically interesting than it was given credit for.
You know, I did the music for Everybody Loves Raymond.
Of course. Yeah. You wrote the theme song, right?
Yeah, and with Terry Trotter. And yeah.
Congrats, that turned out to be a...
Yeah, that was really great.
Yeah.
And I was with Tom Caltabiano and Ray. I think Tom tells me a story where Tom and Ray went to see a movie and it was, they were on the road or something.
Yeah.
It was not a good movie and Showgirls was playing next door. So they walked out of the movie, they walk in, and he goes, all of a sudden, you pop up on the screen. And Ray, I think Tom said to Ray, that's Murata. I think that's Murata. And they fucking called me. It was pretty funny.